At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Welcome to the Friday follow-up for season 18, episode 32, in which Bob welcomed back the Murder Sheets, Kevin and Anya, to have a very rational, reasonable, and pleasant conversation about a very sticky subject, the Delphi case and Richard Allen. There's going to be a part two coming up next week. So right now we're going to focus on your questions for part one, some of the stuff we may address next week. And before we do that, we are sans Zach. Obviously, we miss him. This is a case that's very dear to his heart and very important to him. So hopefully we get a chance to catch up on some of that with him when he's back. But until then, do we have any housekeeping?
Nope, nothing this week other than the Throwback Thursday episode this week. I was digging into old True Crime Binge episodes because I remember Nick from True Crime Garage wrote a book on Delphi also.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I thought I had talked to him after he wrote the book, but I apparently didn't. I think I was on their show, not on my show. Mm. But I did talk to Nick, and we had a long discussion about Delphi in 2021 before, you know, Richard Allen was on anybody's radar and everything. So I thought that would be an interesting. So that's going to, if you're listening to this Friday, it's out now. But yeah, so it's a True Crime Binge episode. So the first half of it is we're just kind of BSing, but then we get into it. It's over an hour long. I just thought it was really interesting to listen back to what we knew, what we thought we knew, and what we didn't know, mm-hmm. you know, back in 2021 about the case. So anyway, that's out there. And I'm trying to put together coming up soon, possibly next week, I'm going to have Bob Mata on to talk about, he's been like at the Lindsey Clancy trial in the courtroom. So he's busy at the trial and then doing his live streams, but we're trying to work that out. Because I know a lot of you guys have been asking about that case. So we're going to have Bob on talk about that soon. Other than that, no, we can get right into this one. We have a ton of comments and questions from listeners this week. I just want to say that I was really glad to finally have this conversation. I'm hoping that this carries through to like our future seasons and stuff, because, you know, every season I get to a point where I'm asking, you know, someone who is on the other side to come on, and it always seems like people think that I'm going to come in and be mean to them or trip them up and try to make this debate. I'm really glad that Kevin and Anya were able to come on and we were able to have a discussion and be, as you said, Janet, it was a nice, reasonable, friendly conversation, which is what we're always looking for. And you'll also have noted that I asked some questions, but I didn't push back a whole lot on it because, as I told them before we started recording, the purpose of the episode was not a debate. It was not for us to argue about, you know, I wasn't trying to change their mind. They weren't trying to change my mind. The purpose of having them on was so that my audience has heard all of the arguments for innocence so that you can also hear an argument for the guilty side without me trying to like interrupt and argue with them.
No, and I would add that at some points, it's not really even about an argument for innocence. It's an argument about guilty or not guilty in a court of law, like whether or not the burden was met. Because as you've said many times in even this episode, like you don't have passionately strong feelings about this being a case of innocence as much as just like a very uncomfortable place where like the evidence lives.
Yeah, I think the best way I can describe it, as I said, is like, I'm just not convinced. I could not, you know, with what I know now, I could not go back into a deliberation room and vote guilty because I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Richard Allen did it. And that's kind of as far as my opinion really goes on it right now.
Yeah. No, I just, and let's get into this, the listener feedback, because yeah, there's definitely always a lot of engagement on Delphi. And for the most part, I think people extended the reasonable atmosphere that you guys were trying to create with a conversation in their engagement on Facebook. And so just to button that up, I do want to say, I mean, I really appreciated what you guys all kind of established at the beginning. And I thought it was really important to hear Kevin say very specifically, look, you know, we turn the other side, quote unquote, into monsters and think like, oh, if you think this person is not guilty, that means you want a pedophile out on the street. And if you think he's, you know, guilty, you want to fry a person who might be innocent, like that there's just this. And he's like, I really appreciated that, you know, he said the quiet part out loud, which is just like, we are human beings. Let's treat each other like human beings. We have all, everybody involved, been guilty of our tempers getting the better of us or snarkiness getting the better of us. We all know that. We've all owned that. This is not a holier than thou where like Kevin and Anya and you and I and Zach are saying like, we've never spoken ill of anyone we disagreed with. No one is saying that. The point is to turn the temperature down. The point is like, wow, we really can get carried away. And like, we need to check back in with each other and recognize that this can be done more respectfully across the board. And that, you know, that it hopefully will kind of also spread to some of the heated stuff that happens in chats and you know, between listeners and stuff. So yeah. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And this is, and it should be noted, like this is in response to, you know, I'm kind of speaking third person now, but from what Janet shared with me in my conversation, some of them with Kevin and Anya, you know, it's not like they're like, man, all these people are talking shit and we want to be show people they can be nice. Like they're aware that, you know, they've gone overboard with that stuff. I'm aware that I have, you know, particularly, you know, our whole season 14, we talked about, you know, so it's not a case of, like you said, where it's, you know, holier than thou, we're showing you we have the moral high ground. A lot of it is, hey, we've all kind of contributed to the ugliness that's gone on. So let's try to back off of that and try to reset a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. And, you know, I've been very clear about sort of where I have hovered in this case, which is like a really uncomfortable state of uncertainty also, which I guess, yes, does mean that, you know, if I had to make a decision today, I would definitely vote not guilty. But I don't know who else it could be. And I continue to feel like there's, you know, fairly compelling evidence to show that it could be him. But anyway, let's kind of get into some reactions and some thoughts and some things that people are bringing in and kind of adding to the discussion. And you made this outline, which I appreciate because you know what's happening in the second part that you're going to be covering with Kevin and Anya. So I'm assuming there isn't too much that spills over into that, that perhaps, you know, we'll
I
be
tried
teeing
to cut
up
all that.
For, yeah.
In the second part, we talked about Judge Gall a lot, is what you guys will hear on Sunday. And we talked about all the confessions. So I tried to like pull that stuff out of this because our patrons who watched it live already heard all that part of it.
Right. Right. Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay, cool. Well, starting with Sandy, just kind of general reactions and totality of the evidence. Sandy said, great discussion. They made some good points, but I don't really agree with the totality three-leg stool analogy in this case. A stool with three rickety legs will also fall over and there is so much at stake. Got that. Kim, meanwhile, is in the murder she camp, believes that the totality of the circumstantial evidence is persuasive without a single smoking gun. The points she finds most important are the vehicle with similar rims, the image of bridge guy, Allen's report placing himself on the bridge, the absence of reports of another similar man, and the confession. She views the cartridge evidence as corroborative and considers the Odinism theory an unsupported distraction. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, it's a difficult one to comment on because I don't want to just say be like, I disagree, but to me, it's not. And again, this is coming from a defense investigator that works in the wrongful conviction space. So I'm always looking very, very closely at the prosecution's case. And I just, you know, and we'll get into more of this with some of the comments more specifically, but the, you know, the vehicle with similar rims, for example, you know, the pictures that we saw when we had like Michael Osbrook on, when I looked at them, like that was compelling to me. I mean, I came away from that conclusion looking at the picture from the surveillance and the picture of his car, believing that's not the same car. Not and for me, and I would suggest anybody that hasn't done that, like look into those photos and look at and come to your own conclusion. But for me, it wasn't a, oh, maybe not. instead it was like, oh, that's not the same car. It can't be because of, you know, where the, you know, where the wheel was compared to the window and things like that. And then all of the part that we'll get into here in a minute is the, you know, the witnesses putting them there. I feel like it's overstated now that I've gone after this episode. I've gone through and like reviewed, because there's a lot of the trial transcripts are out there now, and I've like read some of the reports and trial transcripts more so than I had before. I feel even less and less convinced. Like I feel like it is, that's the best way to put it. It is overstated, in my opinion, to say that, you know, the witnesses who saw bridge guy and Alan putting him there pretty much, you know, kind of locks him into being the guy that was on the bridge. There's a lot more nuance there. So I don't know. I lean more towards what Sandy said in the previous point, which was just that, yeah, the three-legged, you know, stool theory, like it's or a concept that, yeah, it's, to me, those three legs are all really rickety. They're just not solid for me. I would agree with the circumstantial case if it was like, this is for sure, this person saw Richard Allen at this place at this time, and that bullet casing, you know, definitely came from it. You know, it's like, if all three of those things were in the, you know, in the confessions, if all those were like very solid legs, I would agree that circumstantial case makes sense. But to me, all three of them have, not that they're all wrong, but all three of them have problems for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I that makes sense. And I felt like everybody in that conversation that you guys had was like comfortable sort of stipulating to like, hey, there's some of this stuff we just don't know as much about. Or like, you know, that Anya was like, I'm not a gun person. I have to rely on other people who right. are gun people in any direction who, you know, can maybe speak to that differently. And, you know, you were very honest and were like, I wasn't there. Like, I'm still going off of, at least at the time of the conversation that you guys were having, like that you're going off of reporting coming from other people instead of sitting there in the room, and that, you know, that there's always a possibility that something, you know, could have changed for you in that scenario. I don't know. Let's
before
get
you move on to the next one. I want to point out one other thing. One thing I've thought about doing is very difficult in this setting where we're like answering questions back and forth to get into like, because I can't have like transcripts in front of me. I've considered when we're done with this, doing an episode where I can walk through just like in a normal, where I can like write a script and can have that and just kind of break down exactly how I'm feeling. Because I know there's a lot of, there was in that conversation, there will be a lot in this one where it's, I think, and it was, you know, I don't have specifics because I just can't have 25 trial transcripts in front of me while I'm doing this.
Yeah.
So just know, if you guys want it, let me know. But I'm considering doing that, like laying out where my opinion comes from, like by quoting transcripts and how that happened. Because I spent several hours yesterday like reading through the firearms examiner's testimony so I can see what actually was said, you know, in there. And that's helped shape some of my opinions, but it's hard to like recite all that in this setting.
Right. Understood. Well, I can promise you that people do want that. I don't even know that we have to worry about that. I think, again, this is something we saw the engagement in the Facebook page. People really want to talk about this case, even, you know, whether or not they feel in whichever direction they feel. The book, Media Framing and Tone. Yeah, okay, In the Shadow of the Bridge. This is Margaret's comment. Margaret shares Bob's concern. Also, Kevin and Anya, I always feel bad when you've done an episode and then you're not here to sort of speak for yourselves and, you know, and talk about where your heads are. So just want to acknowledge that. Margaret.
And they may be here with us next week.
Okay,
by the way,
yeah, I think that would help, because I always feel like, I always flounder when I'm like, how many times have I said, well, I think the book said, or like, I think. Kind of like you're talking about the trial transcripts. Like, I'm like, ooh, I definitely don't want to speak for someone else or misstate facts, even though I'm sure I've done it a million times and then just try to excuse myself. Like, but I don't really know this case. Margaret shares a concern that the guilt was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. She would like your reaction to Kevin and Anya's book if you do get a chance to read it. She feels that the book minimizes Alan's confinement conditions, the officers investigating the Odinism theory, and the prison psychologist's involvement. She also objects to passages written with certainty about events the authors could not personally know, and add to comments about Bob. Oh, and to comments about Bob and Allison Mata. Yeah, I mean, the book is not a fan of Bob and Allison Mata. That is abundantly clear. I would say that.
And you've read the book. I had not read it. You've read it?
Yeah, I have. And I have a bunch of, like, there was a point at which I thought I was going to be in Indianapolis for a con. I was really excited because I was going to get to, like, sit down and have a meal with them. And, you know, I had some notes and thoughts and questions that were born out of reading the book. And, you know, what I would say is like everyone, I just feel like it's just really hard to escape. Like, you know, that when that book was written, they weren't, my understanding about it, my sense of it is not that they were writing it as they were going along and were kind of flip-flopping back and forth of like, oh, that was a good point. That was a good point. It feels like it is a book written by people who feel very confident in the verdict. And that is their perspective. And so I think that it is, yeah, I would say that I don't think they would argue that it's not, you know, to that tone. It's certainly saying definitively, like, yes, this man is responsible for this murder, or these murders. Everyone, I mean, there are things that people accuse us of leaving out when we are talking about something. And then we say, that just is a nothing burger. Like, we're like, that's not pertinent. It's just not a fact, or it's not whatever. And then people are like, oh, well, I'm just talking about, you know, people who very often, you know, disagree with you, but people will bring something up and we're like, what are you saying that means? And they're like, how can you not see how important that is? And we're like, I don't see it. And then we get accused of like burying something because we don't think it matters. So I'm not saying that that's like, I'm just saying, I think that is still a thing that happens in every direction, depending on what your perspective is on the outcome. So I don't know. I mean, but
Well, that was my big takeaway from our conversation was this wasn't a situation where they were like Kevin and Anya are like, you know, leaving facts out to fit their narrative, or that they're like creating facts that fit their narrative. We're all looking at the same facts. Like, it just in the conversation, I'm realizing it's like it really comes down to how strongly we feel about the different facts.
Right.
That's the big, you know, what it means, you know, what the firearms evidence means to me compared to what it means to them. You know, where I'm not comfortable saying, well, it can't be excluded. And we'll talk again. I don't want to jump ahead, but there's reasons I have more issues with that. But, you know, that Richard Allen's gun can't be excluded, and saying, OK, well, it was his gun. Whereas from their perspective, that exact same thing, I'm saying he can't be excluded. And they're like, well, with everything else put together, that means that was probably his gun. Right. So it's we're looking at the same thing. And I think that on the outline, Kate, right over there, that comment there is actually a direct response to what Margaret said.
OK, so Kate said, Kate pushes back on the claim that the murder sheet distorted the case, characterizing its work as a different perspective that does not conform to the defense narrative. She also recommends Tom Webster's trial coverage and post-trial interview with defense attorney Andrew Baldwin. Yeah, it's very interesting to have heard a lot of the Mata's coverage and Andrea Burkhart's coverage, and then sort of have this perspective of like setting aside, you know, whatever, you know, their opinions of each other. Because I've certainly heard Bob say a lot of, you know, things about the murder sheet, and everyone has an opinion about who lashed out first and all of that. But it's just interesting to hear like a different perspective on those defense attorneys, because it's true that like most of what I was hearing was like pretty glowing. And I think it's fair to say that there are some things that when you look at them in a different light, you're like, oh, that's not great. Like, that's true, you know, I don't think that was necessarily a great choice, or like I kind of question that. Or, you know, there's some stuff like if you're a person who feels more ambivalent about the case, I'm just saying in terms of like whether you passionately believe one way or the other, or have been soundly convinced in one direction or the other, that if you're just listening to both and you don't have an opinion, it's interesting to hear sort of how, like you're saying, how things are perceived and how actions and decisions are perceived. And, you know, I think Kevin and Anya developed a great relationship with law enforcement and with the attorneys, and had positive experiences with them and feel that they're trustworthy and stuff. And I can't question. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know those folks. And the problem is, too, when you get into a space where like you have a strong opinion about one thing or the other, then kind of like we were just talking about with theories about, you know, that the internet trots in about cases where some of that stuff is so crazy that you kind of find yourself going like, please don't take my side. Because now my opinion is going to get lumped in with a bunch of people who are saying this guy, you know, but the prosecutor's a murderer, he's corrupt, or he abuses his kids, or da da da. And then everything swirls together and it starts to feel like, well, if you feel like, you know, if you think that this person is not guilty, then you're probably one of those people who's accusing decent human beings about of all kinds of, you know, bad deeds when you don't know that that's what was going on at all. So I think there's the risk of that, too, is like, you know, you start people start getting demonized instead of like it just being like, well, maybe we just disagree.
My health matters to me, and when my sleep is off, my focus, mood, and even digestion feels harder. That's why I added Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers to my nightly routine, a 7-form blend designed to support relaxation and overall sleep quality. And now they've taken it further, and this is big. They launched Magnesium Breakthrough Advanced 10, 10 bioavailable forms, plus active vitamin B6 and ionic trace minerals to support uptake. And they actually test for bioaccessibility to help ensure the magnesium is available for absorption. Their most complete formula yet for sleep, recovery, stress, and metabolic support. More brands are trying to copy Multiform Magnesium now. What's harder to copy is the testing behind it and the trust of over 1 million customers who've already put it to the test. So here's my challenge to you. Try it. Track your sleep and see how you feel. Because it's worth it to feel like yourself again and maybe even better. Head to bioptimizers.com/truth and use code TRUTH for 15% off your order. Use my link and code and you'll unlock exclusive discounts for friends of the show, plus surprise free bonuses and bigger discounts Bioptimizers rolls out during certain windows. You can also get free shipping on select orders. And every order is backed by their 365-day money-back guarantee so you can try it with confidence. You won't find this on Amazon and stores or anywhere else. That's bioptimizers.com/truth, code TRUTH. One thing I love about summer is how simple life gets. Becky and I spend a lot of time outside. Whether we're hiking, traveling, sitting around a campfire, or just running errands, I tend to wear the same handful of comfortable clothes over and over again. That's one of the reasons I've become a fan of Quince. They make high-quality essentials that are comfortable, versatile, and easy to wear. Their 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, lightweight, and exactly the kind of clothing I want during the hottest part of summer. And they start at just $34. Their t-shirts are incredibly soft, and their lightweight cotton sweaters are perfect for those cooler evenings when the temperature drops after sunset. Now, what really stands out to me is the value. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality and not a brand markup. Personally, I found myself reaching for the same Quince linen shirt whenever we're traveling or spending a day outdoors. It's one of those pieces that just always looks good, it feels comfortable, and it works whether I'm heading out to dinner or spending the day exploring. It's become a regular part of my summer fit. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a trusted favorite for everything from home to travel to everyday essentials. So make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/rough for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rough for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rough.
This summer, whatever you're watching, baseball, golf, soccer, racing, DraftKings has you covered for every single moment of it. The DraftKings Sports app is now available in all 50 states, bringing the game straight to your fingertips wherever you are. New DraftKings customers, sign up with code KSR. Spend $5 to get $150 in rewards within 14 days. Includes all markets. That's code KSR. In partnership with DraftKings, the crown is yours. Bet with DK Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 1-800-MY-RESET. Connecticut, call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino in Kansas, bet tax pass-through may apply in Illinois. 21 plus, void in Canada. Event contract trading with DraftKings predictions involves risk of loss. Availability varies. Predictions offer void in New York. Bet to get bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Trade to get prediction dollars that expire in 1 year. $50 in rewards issued every 7 days via click to claim for 14 days. One non-withdrawable reward redeemable. Terms at dkng.co/offer. Limited time offer.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle. You'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to point out that I think in general, and Kevin and I had, I think in one of the previous episodes he was on with me, we had this exact conversation, but people have a really hard time seeing other people's perspectives. You know, for someone who is, I consider myself to be pretty neutral in this case, looking at it, it's like, I can see, like, the guilty side makes the argument that Mata and Burkhart and Osbrook and them, like, they're tied in and connected with the defense, and everything they're saying is from the defense side of it. On the kind of innocent side argument, looking on, like, the same thing could be said from the other way. Like, Kevin and Anya, as you mentioned, are very, you know, have gotten very close with, like, the prosecution and the law enforcement side and everything. So it's like, I think those cut both ways, and you could see how both those perspectives kind of come through, because, you know, one has a connection over here, and one side has a connection over here. But it's like both sides don't see it in themselves. They only see the other side.
Right.
So they're like, oh, well, they're connected to the defense. So that obviously they're going to, it's like, yeah, but you're connected. Your connection is to the prosecution, and you're doing the same thing they're doing, and vice versa. I didn't mean to put it like that way. The same thing from the innocent side. They're like, of course they're saying that. They're buddied up with the prosecutors. Like, yeah, but you're doing the same thing.
Right.
Like, you're buddied up with the defense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and again, like, I thought you guys had a very reasonable conversation, and things that you were pushing back on, like, there were things that, you know, Kevin and Anya were like, yeah, that was not ideal. Like, I appreciated the fact that they, you know, we all can say, like, wow, what a mess with, like, losing documents and losing footage. And, you know, yes, he said a law enforcement officer said, like, yeah, in my notes, he said he was there at X time. But, like, I can't prove that, you know, I didn't record it. I don't have a real log of that. And for you, kind of in the work you do, coming from the perspective that you come from, and you can call that bias, I'm sure people will, when it doesn't suit their needs. I'm not speaking about Kevin and Anya. I'm saying, like, certain listeners are just going to hear what they're going to hear. Yeah. But, you know, that like, you, for them, that's not, you know, that's not a game changer. And for you, you're like, sometimes not having a log of something, I'm not saying that the person who made that note was, like, a terrible person who goes to bed at night rubbing his hands together thinking about an innocent life he's going to ruin. But, like, it's just hard to know if those notes are reliable, and that they totally acknowledge that. Like, Kevin and Anya were like, I totally see that. Like, yes, that's not ideal. Like, there was a cluster that happened here, and but that doesn't necessarily push away enough of the other stuff they find compelling to then say, OK, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. But yeah, do you want to move on to? Oh yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as we move through the outline, as I'm just looking at time and the fact that I'm going to probably put an episode together where I'm covering this, let's hold off on Kat's. So Kat, one of our listeners, made a post where she had with all the receipts, like point by point by point, all the different things that she wanted to correct, or like questions maybe that we had during the conversation. I'll circle back to it if we need to, but we have so much other stuff to get to, and I'm going to cover this stuff later. So, Kat, I just don't want Kat to feel like we're just ignoring it. It's going to take a long time to get through all that. So let's jump down to the trial witnesses.
Okay.
Bridge guide, the timeline. If we have time, we'll circle back to Kat. Otherwise, I'll work that stuff into the episode I'm going to put together.
Okay, cool. Rebecca has several concerns about the trail witness argument. Why is Alan's description of three girls treated as an imperfect memory of the group of four, while the girl's brief identification of the man as bridge guy is treated as reliable? If a girl remembered a, quote, death stare, quote, but could not identify Alan, what does that establish? Do you want me to, like, read through the... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so that was one of the things, and this, again, is where I was reading through all these transcripts today, too, and I want to, like, be able to, like, cite them, but I was, like, reading through, I think one, there was, like, Voorhees was one of the names, and there were the girls that were testifying, and I don't know, like, when I read their transcript, I didn't come away feeling like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, they for sure saw Richard Allen. So, you know, what their statements are is the person they saw is, they're certain, is the guy from the picture,
video.
Bridge guy.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What they didn't say was that it looked like him. Now, we talked about the fact that, you know, there's reasons why neither side wanted to say, you know, do you see the person in this courtroom? You know, it was a huge risk for either side, you know, for the prosecution. If she's like, no, well, then they're like, ha, it's not him. And if the defense does it and she's like, well, I think it might have been him, then they're screwed, right? So nobody's going to ask that question. I understand why they didn't ask the question. But in reading through their transcript, the biggest thing I noticed was that, you know, they're all describing that they were very close. They all said they had like a face covering, very close. They all described him as young, 20s, 30s. One, I think, said he had like bushy blonde hair and that he was taller. I think one of the witnesses was, I don't know, was like 5'7 or something like that, and said that she came up to his shoulder.
That he was tall. To be clear, because I don't want you to get any heat for this. You're not saying that he was a taller man. You're saying that the people all said that he was taller than they were, because 5'7"
They all described him. They all described him as being like not like an incredibly tall person, but like as being like average to tall. And there was one specifically, and this is one of the things I need to have the transcript in front of me, because one of the witnesses
testimony
I was reading,
in court, not even like a police document.
Yeah, well, and I was also referencing back to police statements, too. That's why I need to go through it all. But I don't remember if it was a police statement or one of the testimonies at trial. But the person was saying that they were like, the witness was, I want to say, 5'7". And either testified to or said in their statement that the person they saw that they're sure was Bridge Guy was wearing those clothes, that it was the guy in the photo, that when they walked past him, like their head came to his shoulder, like he was taller than them. And of course, and all of that like is meaningful to me because Richard Allen is very short.
Right.
I mean, very short. So they, like most people, I think, would describe him as short. He was also not in his 20s or 30s. So it was just like when I was reading those accounts, like it's easy to take the piece of those statements and that testimony and be like, well, they said they walked by. It was about this time and they saw Bridge Guy walk by. And then when it becomes significant, and I agree with this, right, then they tie that in with Richard Allen's statement saying he was there between 1:30 and 2:30 is what Doolin's report said. And they're like, well, they're saying they saw a guy wearing that. He says he was there at that time, and he says he saw a group of girls. And if we put all that together, it has to be them. But what I don't agree, I'm not saying it can't be him. But I disagree with the statement that a lot of people make that is it has to be him. Like, right. Like based on all these things, by process of elimination, it's him. Because there's even timing issues. There was a photo taken that was time stamped. And people get confused, too, when people talk about that they were by the Freedom Bridge, that there's two bridges at opposite ends of this trail. There's the Freedom Bridge and then there's the Monon High Bridge, which is where the murder, you know, where, you know, we see the video in the picture of Bridge Guy. And there's like time discrepancies between like, well, if they took this picture here and they saw him by, and then Richard Allen, when he said he read that three girls he said he saw were near the Freedom Bridge, the complete opposite end of the trail from where Bridge Guy was on the bridge. So yeah, there's the more and more I look into it, I'm like, I personally cannot come to the conclusion that, when you put all these pieces together, they all point to Richard Allen.
Yeah.
I can't get there. It's like you've got witnesses that are saying they see a 20 to 30 year old male with blonde bushy hair that's taller, you know, a taller person. You know, there's four of them. The girl, he said he saw three girls by the, and I was not able to see, and I don't think Kevin and Anya claimed this, because I know I asked them the question. We could ask them next week if they come back on, but like, you know, it was kind of like, well, that was the only group of three girls that were there. I'm like, I haven't seen any
information. That was very compelling to me. I mean, that was very compelling to me. It was like, if you can't account for who the three girls were that he saw when in this small community, where I don't know why those three girls wouldn't have come forward to be like, yes, I was also there. That does seem compelling to me. So if that, are you saying that's not the case? That like there were, other girls?
I'm not saying that's not the case, but I think it's overstated to say... there definitely was not another group of three girls there.
Okay.
Like there was not another group of three girls that were interviewed that I found. But like, right. I also didn't find like they've exhausted. They can account for every single person that was there. I don't see where that's the case. And there's also the timing. And I think I brought this up when I was talking to them, too. But it's like, but what if the timing he gave is wrong? Right. So what if it was 12:30, not 1:30? And they're looking for people that were there at, you know, around 2:30. And this encounter he had was at 12:30. Did they talk to all the people that were there? That, you know, there's just a whole lot of what ifs in there. And again, none of it is me saying, so that means Richard Allen's innocent. It just means to me, Like, I don't come to that. I don't look at all these pieces of this puzzle and end up with the same picture that some, that people maybe that are on the guilty side of the argument are coming to. I'm like, that's not a lock to me at all. You know, it'd be one thing if they're all like, yeah, I saw a guy, it was a shorter guy and, you know, older and, he said he saw a group of four girls and then there was this group of four girls, you know, in the timing with the pictures and when they were at the Freedom Bridge and if like all that stuff was lining up. Yes. But it doesn't all line up.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know what being in the courtroom would feel like. I mean, I really respect Anya for saying, like, I know this isn't evidence, but like I was in the courtroom. I heard I heard him speak. I've seen him. Like, that's Bridge Guy. Like, that she was like, I know that's not evidence, but like she owned the fact that like it really seemed like it was him from a common sense perspective. I'm not saying that swayed her, but I'm saying like as a fellow human being, had I been sitting in that courtroom, had I heard that tape and also heard tape of Richard Allen and been there in that process during that process, and I'm speaking also for the jury, because obviously they did find him guilty. Mm-hmm. I can't say what that piece might affect. Like, it really might affect me if I'm like, God, I just, that's him. Like, that's him. Yeah. I feel that's him. And I wasn't there. Like, that's, you know, that could be very powerful in a way that even when you say it's not evidence, like that feels, you know, that's tough to ignore.
I agree. It can be powerful to a person, whether it's the jury or it's Anya or anybody else that was there. I appreciated her saying that it's not, you know, that's not evidence because, you know, and I didn't push back on it in the episode because it just is not worth, wasn't worth it. But I've said it before. The same thing I say when people are like, and I think one of them made passing mention of this, like, you know, Bridge Guy was short. The height was right. And I was like, listen, like, we can't know that. Like, right. The FBI and all the most, you know, skilled people that do this as experts in the world tried to compare the voices and didn't come to conclusion that it was inconclusive, right? Whether it was with him or not. I think there was an officer that like heard him on the phone. There was somebody from law enforcement that said it was his voice, but there were other experts that looked at it that were unable to determine. Same thing with the height, you know, like. They're like, well, I've looked at that and I know for a fact that's a short guy. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, the photogrammetry experts weren't able to come to that conclusion. So like you're guessing. Yeah. And then I think it's also, and I don't know, and actually, I don't know if we have a question about this, so I'll bring it up here. Because one thing I said, I couldn't remember what conclusion I came to, what Libby said in the tape. It was that we go down. That's what was. And by the way, your listener, Rachel Riggs, she made a post about this on the fan page, but she put together a little YouTube video where she's an audio engineer where she like cleaned up the audio again, similarly to what I did when we talked about this. Mm-hmm. And I hear the same thing. I hear, you know, this is the path, pause, Abby runs by, that we go down. That's what I hear.
Oh, that's what I heard other too. People, yeah, I just didn't realize that's, yeah, okay. I remember that back
And then
in
other
the
people
day,
hear, but this is the path, pause, Abby runs by, that be a gun.
Which could be her saying, could that be a gun? Like, but just she didn't hear the could or something like that.
Yeah. Or people are just like, she said it in a funny way or something like that. I think that either way you look at it, I'm not saying one's right or one's wrong, but I think it's similar to the voice you hear, the height you see. I think that we all, and I do it too. I'm not claiming to be immune from this. I think that we don't want to maybe admit to ourselves that our own personal bias and beliefs come through things like that. Like if you go into listening to that section of tape and you've been told and you're convinced that she says that be a gun and people you know and trust have told you she said that be a gun and then you listen to it, you're probably going to hear her say that be a gun. Conversely, if you've been told that she's saying that we go down, or it's the blue dress, gold dress, or whatever type thing, right? Well, that's different. That was something different. But there's all these social media things, right? Where like it'll put a word on the screen and play the audio, and whatever word it is, that's what you hear. But if they put something else up, I think there's a lot of that that goes on with these things, right? With whether you hear his voice is the same, whether you hear that be a gun or that we go down, how tall the man in the picture is. I think a lot of that is like, and it's not like and I'm not claiming this is a conscious thing. Like, well, I want to believe this, so I'm doing this. I think that if you have in your mind something like that already, then your brain tends to show you what you agree with. And again, not saying one's right or one's wrong, But I think I think it's fair to say that that can have an effect on, you know, all three of those things I just mentioned, actually.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's fair across the board. And again, like, you know, Kevin and Anya are like, they totally respect saying, I don't feel there's enough evidence. It's not compelling enough. This person is not guilty. That's an intellectually honest conclusion to come to. Mm-hmm. That's like, as long as you're dealing with the same information and people are just like interpreting it differently, that's different than, like, you know, starting to bring up things that, you know, aren't conclusive in either direction. But even sometimes that feels like one thing feels conclusive and to someone, and then it doesn't feel conclusive to someone else. Yeah, it's really tricky. And that also everyone in the conversation seemed to be owning, like, yeah, this is not open and shut. That's why it's still so
being talked about,
you know, about. And that, you know, that's intellectually honest. It's very intellectually honest to say, look, I acknowledge that, you know, it can't be that open and shut, because there's tons of people who are kind of interpreting this and experiencing it differently. I appreciate that from every direction. I appreciate that from people who, you know, feel all different kinds of ways about this case, is that at least I like that a lot of people are able to say, wow, you can take away a lot of different things from this case, you know, because then you're not saying, well, it's irrational to think anything but blank, you know, that's kind of what we were hoping to do here.
Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining, if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. One thing I love about summer is how simple life gets. Becky and I spend a lot of time outside. Whether we're hiking, traveling, sitting around a campfire, or just running errands, I tend to wear the same handful of comfortable clothes over and over again. That's one of the reasons I've become a fan of Quince. They make high-quality essentials that are comfortable, versatile, and easy to wear. Their 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, lightweight, and exactly the kind of clothing I want during the hottest part of summer. And they start at just $34. Their t-shirts are incredibly soft, and their lightweight cotton sweaters are perfect for those cooler evenings when the temperature drops after sunset. Now, what really stands out to me is the value. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality and not a brand markup. Personally, I found myself reaching for the same Quince linen shirt whenever we're traveling or spending a day outdoors. It's one of those pieces that just always looks good, it feels comfortable, and it works whether I'm heading out to dinner or spending the day exploring. It's become a regular part of my summer fit. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a trusted favorite for everything from home to travel to everyday essentials. So make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/rough for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's QUINCE.com/rough for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/rough.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Going on to, well, so Jennifer says, if all these people saw Bridge Guy directly, how come none of them can look directly at Richard Allen and say that's him? I got to tell you, I do go into the witness identification thing pretty hard in terms of, like, I am very confident, based on a recent conversation that you and I had where I was like, I tried to remember this guy and I couldn't remember him, that I would absolutely be potentially a useless witness because of my background and what I understand now from doing stuff like this. I would be terrified to identify someone, terrified, because all I could think was, what if it's not him? What if I'm wrong? What if I'm projecting, or what if I saw his picture somewhere? Da, da, da. So I feel that I would not want to be asked, is that the man you saw? I wouldn't be sure, even if I wanted to be sure. So even if someone can't say that's him, to me, that doesn't mean that it wasn't Richard Allen either. I'm just saying that cuts either way for me.
Yeah. And then that really, the fact that nobody was able to do that doesn't mean anything significant to me for all the reasons you just said. And also, you know, you have eyewitness identification is what it is. All those witnesses said he was wearing a face covering, and what, 7 years had gone by, you know, to be like, hey, is this man who's now all emaciated from jail and all this stuff that's 7 years older, is that the same guy you saw in a fleeting glance, right, 7 years ago?
And when you think, like, about it that way, it's really not fair to put witnesses in that position. Like, it's fair. No. Like, everyone was respectfully fair to the witnesses in that they couldn't and wouldn't pin something that definitive on these poor people who were just trying to, you know, do what they were doing in their day and didn't know how important it was going to be.
Yeah. And it'd be different if it was like an hour later or the next day, they're like, here's some pictures. Do you recognize it? And you're like, yeah, that's the person I saw. 7 years later. No, audio man in the YouTube chat just said, under oath, all I'm saying is I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's often the truest and most honest way to go. Marnie asks, what evidence establishes that Bridge Guy was necessarily the killer, even if Allen was Bridge Guy? Could the words and movements on Libby's recording have another interpretation? What proves the killer was one of the people seen on the public trail rather than someone who entered from adjoining property without passing the witnesses or parking areas?
I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Bridge Guy, we're calling Bridge Guy, is the guy that we had a still image of and then later got the video version of that.
Yeah.
That, you know, the still image was a screenshot from the video. I don't have any doubt whatsoever that that was the killer. I mean, when we see the video, we see Bridge Guy is walking towards them. They turn and face him and he says down the hill, and then they walk down the hill and then that's where they're killed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think there's any question that person in that video, Bridge Guy, is the person that killed them.
Yeah.
So if Richard Allen is, and that this is part of my problem, right? Nobody identifies Richard Allen as that guy. You know, we have witnesses that all say we saw that guy, but they didn't say it was Richard Allen who was that guy.
Right.
You know, well, and that's the disconnect for everybody. That's the struggle that, say, like Kevin and Anya or anybody on the kind of guilty side that they have to struggle with is, there isn't a clear identification of him as Bridge Guy. You have to use circumstantial evidence to get there, kind of putting those pieces of puzzle together to get there. And from the innocent side, there's no one saying that I for sure saw him and he was someone else, right? And nobody's saying that it's not him either.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Okay. Doolin interview, change times, and the missing phone. Kate says, with your expertise in statement analysis and suspect behavior, doesn't it make you leery that right after the crime, Richard Allen wouldn't meet Doolin, I'm so sorry, I don't remember. And it's written Doolin. Law enforcement at his home, place of business, or at the police station and gave a statement of 1:30, not knowing the timing of the crime, but 5 years later is willing to go to a police station with a new time of being at Bridge. Do you want to start with that? Like that's so yeah, the question is like, we'll if you're doing statement analysis, it's dishonest to not acknowledge some of that behavioral red flag stuff.
Yeah. So first of all, there's a couple things that, I mean, this isn't a statement analysis. You know, we're looking at a note from a report from earlier, right? So it's not a statement analysis. And I want to be clear too, as I try to make clear, like I consider this one of my areas of specialty because of my education and experience doing it. I am certainly not an expert in statement analysis. But as far as what Kate says here, does it make me leery that he wouldn't meet him at his home? It's similar to a lot of things like we talked about. They talk about like what he said to his wife. Like there's just too many variables for me to put any weight one way or the other into that. Like, and also when I read through Doolin's testimony, you know, he doesn't say that Allen was, as a matter of fact, he says that, you know, he seemed normal. He didn't see anything wrong with him. You have to remember that the reason he was talking to Richard Allen was because Richard Allen called and said, hey, I was there. And it appears, and I think that he probably did say 1:30 at that time when I was reading through the testimony, because the way the notes were in his initial notes, the lead sheet says from 1 to 3. So the lead would have been when Richard Allen called in and said, I was at the bridge. I was on the trail from around 1 to 3.
Yeah.
And then he corrected it once he interviewed him in his report to say 1:30 to 3:30.
Okay.
So it seems, I mean, is it possible he actually said 12:30? Or because the problem with Doolin is he had all his handwritten notes from the meeting and then he transcribed them into the report and he threw away his handwritten notes. So if there was like a transcribing error or anything like that, like we don't know because we don't have the original. But I mean, it seems reasonable that's what he said. As far as him like not meeting, what I mean by there's too many variables for me to put any weight into that is, I don't know why he don't, you know, do you want a bunch of cops showing up to your house to do an interview and your neighbor seeing it? Do you want them showing up to your work or go to the station, or were you already going to the store? None of these questions are answered in any of the reports, right? So was it, you know, was he like, hey, do you want me to come to your house or you can come to the station? If he's like, he could have said, you know, well, I'm on my way to the Save-A-Lot right now. You want to just meet me there and we can talk or whatever. I have no idea why that is. And there's too many variables as far as why someone would do that. The other thing is, so you said that it is at the time, he says 1:30 and she had put in parentheses, not knowing the time of the crime. I assume she means that like he says 1:30 when he doesn't know what time the crime happened. But then when he finds out it was, you know, at 2:30, then he moves the time
back.
Well,
that can't be what she means, because if you don't know what time the crime was committed, then you didn't commit the crime. So that can't be what she means, because she thinks that he's for sure guilty. So I guess I'm confused.
Yeah. Yeah. So that if that's what she's saying, that kind of cuts that way. But also, I disagree that he didn't know what time the crime was committed, because when I looked up and it was like on the 14th, there was already, and this was, I think, the 17th, something like that, or... Yeah, I think by the 14th and 15th, there was all kinds of news reports saying what time the girls that were last seen and had gone missing. So it was, you know, it was known very publicly already the time frame at that time. So I think that's irrelevant, them not knowing the time frame. Yeah. So there's just a couple of things as far as that part of the question. It doesn't mean anything to me that he wanted to meet at the Save-A-Lot, because I don't know the circumstances. And even if I knew the circumstances, you know, there's still, you know, there's plenty of reasons why a guilty person might not want to meet at their home. There's also plenty of good reasons why an innocent person may not want to have an interview with police at their home.
Yeah. Oh, maybe Kate was saying like it was unclear what time everyone thought the crime happened, or like that maybe even the cop wouldn't know that. I'm not sure. But and yeah, you do say that usually people's statements are closer to true. Like you guys even talked about that in the podcast, in the conversation.
Oh, that's at the next part of her question.
Yeah. that people are more accurate, tend to be more accurate right after something.
Oh,
right,
yeah,
after
we didn't read the next part of her question. So
yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, there's a note about, you know, you of all people have said many times that the most reliable statements come from the time period closest to crime, which I think Anya pointed out, which I think is true. I mean, you have always said that.
Yeah, I mean the only issue here, a couple things that are issues here. One is, which is not really a big issue. Like I feel like saying it's an issue sounds like it's like conspiratorial in it, and I don't mean it that way or that it was anything nefarious. But just the fact that all we have is this report about what he said, not the initial notes, not any recorded. Like we don't know for certain that is exactly what he said, and that's only in question because he claims later that's not what he said. If it is accurate, I would say, yeah, probably 1:30. But then there's also always the, like, did he know exactly the time? Was he watching his watch when he did it? You know, I don't know. I don't, my opinion on this is, and I guess I should have made this clear in the episode, on innocence or guilt, doesn't hinge at all on whether Richard Allen was on the trails from 1:30 to 2 or 12:30 to 1. There was lots of people on the trails at that time. We know that he was on the trails that day sometime around then. So it's not that, unless somebody is saying, I saw him, that guy, following those girls, it's not that significant. So I just don't want to make it seem like my argument is that he definitely was not there at 1:30. I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
I just wish that we had more, I just wish it was more of a solid time.
Right. And then the last piece from Kate was, what reason is the device he said he used at the bridge was not one of the 20 plus devices found in his residence 5 years later? He had kept plenty of his old phones except that one. Good discussion, but I don't feel like you're even taking in their side. You have your mindset. Yeah, I will say, while I don't necessarily agree with all of that, I'm trying to remember. I got to ask Kevin and Anya, because for some reason, I feel like I was listening for that part about them looking for the phone and the phone being gone. It must be in the book, but for some reason, I somehow can't remember it being in there. I'm sure it is, so I'll ask them where it is. But that's another one that, like, I did not care for. I did not like that they couldn't get that phone, but there are all these other phones lying around. I definitely was like, ooh, that's not a great look.
I mean, maybe. I was just thinking when I saw, again, it doesn't, like, cut one way or the other for me, because if you go into our junk drawer in my house, there's probably 6 old iPhones in there, but they're not all of our old iPhones.
No, that's some true for them, me too, I guess.
You know what I mean? Like some of them I traded in. Some of them I had to replace them because they got it. As a matter of fact, I don't remember if it was from an interview or where it came from. It was somewhere in my mind, and someone had fact checked me on this. I thought that, like, Kathy had said at one point that one of the reasons he had to replace a phone is because it got run over by a lawnmower or something. Mm. Like, I've jumped in pools with phones. The fact that he didn't have that one particular phone, but he had other phones, again, and I feel like Kate is going to be like, oh, you're trying to excuse. All I'm saying is, like, this, it's like, there's a million variables. There's a million variables that no one can possibly know on either side of the argument as to why that phone's not there. As far as the point she said, where it says good discussion, but it feels like you're not even taking in their side and you have your mindset, like, that, first of all, the stuff you brought up in this post, they didn't make that argument to me. You know, it's not like they said that and I refuted that. They didn't bring that up. That's not part of what they said makes them believe that Richard Allen is guilty. So that wasn't part of the discussion. And as far as, you know, I'm not taking it in and have their mind made up, I disagree. I mean, I took in everything they said, and it only comes down to, yeah.
Well,
and
I'm
I think if you're fans of Kevin and Anya, I think that you should, you know, hear them and what they're saying in this discussion. Like, we're all coming to this conclusion. It's their argument that I'm discussing with them. And like they said, like, I get it. You don't feel like that, you know, we're looking at the same evidence. I can see why they hold that evidence to be something stronger than what I see it. And they can see why I maybe don't weigh it as strongly. That's not listening to each other. It's just not interpreting it exactly the same.
And sorry, I interrupted you, but I'm just going to say, I'm very sure, and a lot of it you're seeing here in the Facebook posts, is that, like, I'm sure there are people that are like, Kevin and Anya didn't even hear what Bob was saying when he said that he wasn't comfortable with that. Like, they heard, you know, there are people who feel like Kevin and Anya, I promise you, weren't listening to you, and, like, everybody was just in their corner. You know, you guys just, you couldn't even hear all the rational points that Bob was making. Like, that's happening. That's still happening. The point was to try to like not have that happen, but that's still happening. I guess the most important takeaway is like, did the three of you feel like you respectfully had a conversation and like heard each other out and did what you set out to do? And beyond that, the interpretation that everyone has of like what that takeaway was, you can't control. And neither can they.
I think you just can't fall, and not you specifically, Kate, just anyone, like you can't fall into the trap in life in general in thinking that because someone disagrees with your conclusion, that they must not be listening or they must be biased. It's all the stuff Kevin said at the top of the episode, right? Like, I did listen. I'm still listening to them. I'm still, and I've taken from what they said, and it's caused me to research and read more and all that. Like, I am listening. I don't have a dog in this fight. It doesn't matter to me. You know, it's not going to make a difference in my life one way or the other if Richard Allen's innocent or guilty. I just want to understand the case better. And so the fact that, like, I don't want to keep rambling on. It's just, that's something that always just drives me crazy when people do, where it's like, oh, you disagree with me. It must be because XYZ reason. It couldn't possibly be just because you're interpreting facts differently.
Right. Firearm evidence and the burden of proof. This is our last piece for today. Ryan objects to describing the cartridge evidence as a match. He argues that could not be excluded is materially different from identification and compares it to older blood type evidence that could include a large share of the population. He sees this kind of comparison as more useful for exclusion than for proving that one particular gun was the source. And then Josh asks exactly which features were compared between Allen's gun and the crime scene cartridge. Was there a corresponding firing pin mark or a distinctive chamber wear pattern? Were other guns of the same model and caliber adequately tested? He also objects to, oh no, it cut off. My page is cutting me off and it's not letting me see the rest of that. Hold on.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
I'll continue on.
Okay.
He also objects to the suggestion that the defense had to prove that the witness's man was not Allen or that the cartridge did not match, emphasizing the burden remained with the state. With both, so first of all, to Josh, when you're one question, like firing pin marks, and the round found at the scene was not fired, so there was no firing pin mark. I agree with Ryan wholeheartedly. I think Ryan actually summed this up so clearly better than I have articulated it before, in that this was good for the testing will work for me for exclusion, like this one could be excluded, but not for inclusion to the exclusion of all others, which was kind of the way that, you know, that Anya was kind of saying that, you know, in her, she didn't say this was a fact. She just said in her mind, it's a match based on what she heard in the testimony. My issues with it are exactly, so what they were looking for, Josh, was like, there was three different parts. It was like the ejector mark. I don't remember, again, this is, I need to go back to the trend, but there are three different, it was all part of a bullet being ejected from the gun. When I looked at the testimony, it's, as we had said before, there was, I believe, six times they tried ejecting rounds, unspent rounds out of Richard Allen's gun, and they were unable to make any kind of determination from that because the marks weren't deep enough. So then they fired some, and then they were able to, once they fired them, which causes, with the heat and the pressure, causes the marks to be deeper, then they were able to compare them. There's kind of two ways to look at that. And from what I read in the, because the defense put on an expert as well, it's a weird area because it's the way I was reading it, and I'll have to read it again, it's almost like it's never been done before. So like the question comes up, can you compare a spent to an unspent? And it was, and the answer that came out of trial, the way I was reading it was, I mean, nobody's ever, there's no studies on it because it's not been done. There's the argument that's like, well, yeah, when you fire it, it makes the marks deeper, so they're easier to compare. I very strongly have the argument of, yeah, but if when it wasn't fired, it didn't make that mark, then that means it doesn't make that mark when it's not fired.
Right. That's what I've always thought. I'm so uneasy about that one.
The bigger part that I was shocked about, because I've been told, right, like, you know, that it could be any of these 6 hour P whatever guns, that wasn't said at trial. But what did come out at trial is she didn't test it against any other guns. So I had mentioned Brad Weber's gun in the episode. So Brad Weber's gun, they tested with his, they took an unspent round, mm-hmm. just like they did with Richard Allen's gun. Mm-hmm. And just like with Richard Allen's gun, it was inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
She said that it was inconclusive. It could not be excluded or included. It was inconclusive. But then with Richard Allen's gun, they went and fired it a bunch until they finally got to where they had the marker. They didn't do that with his.
Oh,
but more concerning to me is and concerning in the way that, like, I would feel more comfortable with the evidence if this was done.
Right.
They did not, she did not test any other Sig Sauer, the same model gun. You know, like, if she had, like, we got six of the exact same models, tested those, and it's only his that made that mark. She didn't do that. She didn't test it to any other guns. So, like, she was able to say, of all the guns I tested, his was the only one that can't be excluded, and it's positive, you know, so I can positively say that it has sufficient agreement and it came from this gun. But there was nothing else to compare it to. She didn't. She certainly didn't fire rounds out of other guns, unless she did with Weber's, but it didn't say that she did with Weber's to do what she did, go as far as she went with Richard Allen's gun to get those marks. But then also, so the question I had was, well, could that have come from any gun of the same make and model? Well, the answer is we have no fucking idea. She didn't test any of them. No other guns of that make and model were tested to see if they would make it. And then I looked for, and this is me, you know, kind of back to what Kate was saying, like me trying to take in what they're saying and trying to learn more about it so I can see, is my argument incorrect or is it flawed? So then I was like, well, one thing we're always looking for is, was there any unique tool marks, right? So like there's a defect in the gun, you know, or like say we hear about a lot with like knives too, is like this knife had a bend in the blade. We can tell from the, right? So there's something very unique to that gun. There were no, from my understanding of the testimony, there was no unique character. There was no like defect that in Richard Allen's gun that caused one of those marks, which means, again, I'm not an expert in this, but the way I'm interpreting it means, so the regular ejector and chamber and all the different things that are part of every single one of those Sig Sauer guns made those marks, which tells me that any Sig Sauer gun can make. She ruled out, the only thing she ruled out was it didn't come from I think it was a Glock or a Smith & Wesson. It didn't come from either of those two that they tested those two. That's it. Those are the only ones that are ruled out. Brad Weber's gun wasn't excluded. Wasn't included either. It was inconclusive, just like Richard Allen's was when they did unspent it or use an unspent round. So yeah, I mean, I long and short of it, this is the conclusion I came to. I heard what they said, and I listened, and what I heard was, okay, well, the way it was presented to me was like this was really nowhere close to being a match. Kevin and Anya came away thinking, yeah, that was definitely his gun. So I just did a bunch more, you know, I read through the transcripts, I read through the reports and tried to get an idea of, you know, which kind of argument is better. And I came to the same conclusion where I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not comfortable saying that bullet came from Richard Allen's gun. I'm comfortable saying it could have come from his gun, but that's as far as I can go with it.
Yeah, same for me. That's been the cartridge, the gun evidence was the most, like, kind of terrifying to me, because it just makes me so, like, again, if a loved one of mine was in that position and that was the evidence that was presented to prove that my loved one was a murderer, I would be like, can no one see how unreliable this seems? But if my loved one was killed by someone and I was convinced that the person who did it had that gun with them and expended that shell, I might very well be like, how is this not enough? Look, it matches. Like, yeah. I don't know, you know, but as a neutral party, I'm extremely uneasy about it. Extremely uneasy. Yeah, that's just my opinion.
And I've just tried to like take like my feelings about it out and just be like, well, like, what does this information tell me? Like, what does it, and all it tells me is that round didn't come from a Glock or a Smith & Wesson. It could have come from a Sig Sauer P. I keep forgetting the number, P something. And by the way, Brad Weber's gun was a different, it was a different model of Sig Sauer. But his couldn't be, it's like, well, we can't say it wasn't Brad Weber's. It seems like it very well could have been Richard Allen's gun. And it also could have been any other gun of that same make and model. Because we don't have any evidence to the contrary on that. And there was nothing to indicate it came from his. I know you said your outline cut off. There is another section, but we're going to save. The next section was confessions, denials, and conditions of confinement.
Oh, yeah,
all
that
stuff is
covered.
Yeah, all that stuff is covered. These were kind of a long part of our conversation here, but we can fit those into next week. But the final question came from Robert, and I'll pose it to you, Jana, and to me. But Robert asked, did any of the points made change your opinion or make you more doubtful of Richard Allen's innocence?
Well, I am very, I have always been doubtful of Richard Allen's guilt, and I have been doubtful of his innocence. So I guess I object to the question in that I feel like
did it change your opinion one way or the other?
Did it change my opinion? It didn't. I'm still very uncomfortable with all of it. I feel like that we would know if there were three other different girls there. I feel like we would know that, but that I have nothing to base that on other than just a feeling, because I don't know enough about the case to know if that, you know, if that search was done or if that information was lost or that there just simply weren't other people. That's, you know, there are things about it that make me uncomfortable in one direction, and then there are things about it that make me really uncomfortable in evidentiary ways in other ways. So I guess it didn't change my opinion. It didn't change my opinion of me just really thinking this is this entire case is a cluster and an absolute immense tragedy any way you cut it. Just absolutely devastating. Nothing feels good to me about this, nor should it, I don't think. But I appreciate people being able to talk about it and accept, like, I accept that you don't think this is enough. And can you accept that someone else thinks it is, that type of thing, you know?
Yeah, I have not changed my opinion about it at all in either direction. So kind of what I was hoping for with having Kevin and Anya on was that there was something that was, and truthfully, like, I feel really good about this but when the time it's over, I thought, if they come on and they're like, well, here's the evidence that no one's told you about, because they were, you know, they were defense minded and they were trying to hide this evidence from you. So like my mind could have been changed by, here's this evidence you never heard of before. Everything they presented, I've already heard. I already knew. It did cause me to look more into it. And in doing that, I didn't come away with, oh, well, now I'm really sure he's innocent. It didn't do that for me. To be honest with you, it was kind of refreshing overall. It still makes the case extremely frustrating to me, obviously, as it is to most people. But it was kind of good to have the conversation and be like, oh, okay, so this really is a case, like, nothing bad's happening on either side.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Mata and Michael Osbrook and Andrea Burkhart aren't, you know, lying and hiding evidence. They just interpret it a certain way and come to a certain conclusion. In the same way that Kevin and Anya aren't, you know, hiding and making up evidence. They're looking at the same evidence we're looking at, and they've come to a different conclusion. So yeah, I felt better about that. But for me, like, I was always in this week's episode, all we covered really was the timeline and the bullet. I was already well aware of all those things. And so, you know, in the discussion, it served more to me to understand where they're coming from. But it certainly didn't sway me one way or the other. You know, I mean, reading through the testimonies and seeing the descriptions that those witnesses gave of Bridge Guy, the guy that they walked past, I think led me more to believe that the person they saw was not Richard Allen. But again, whether they saw Richard Allen or not, that still doesn't put him, you know, on the bridge with the girls. So it's still a bit ambiguous to me. But the short answer to your question is no, Robert, it didn't change my opinion on innocence or guilt. I wish it did. I wish I could come away with all this being like, well, now I'm convinced he's innocent, or now I'm convinced he's guilty. And I don't have that.
And that's not something, I mean, Kevin and Anya didn't come on to say, like, if we haven't done our job, if you don't believe that he's guilty by the end of this. They were like, we totally respect your perspective and we respect your conclusion, even if it's, you know, totally different from ours.
Yeah. And well, and that was our conversation before we got on, was this is, you know, the intention here is not to be a debate. It's just to let everybody hear the other argument. And we did that. So Hopefully you guys will enjoy the next episode. So coming up Sunday is part two of that conversation. In this one, we get into Richard Allen's confessions, his statement to police. We get into Judge Gall, we talk quite a bit about Monica Walla, the prison psychologist. So all that stuff is coming up on Sunday. And then we'll be back, I believe, on Monday next week is when we will be doing our follow-up on that episode. And it's possible. I know Kevin Anya is there. I think they said they're in Ireland this week.
Oh, cool.
But
I'm jealous.
Next
I
week
I
they said
Ireland.
They.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yep. They should be back next week. So we may be able to have them on. with us next week. That seemed to go well last time. So until then, we'll talk to you guys next week and make sure you tune in on Sunday.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to FinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
FinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit FinQuest.com for more details.